Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas, this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court has two matters on its oral submission docket today. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 080941, the Travelers Insurance Company versus Barry Joaquin from Lubbock County and the 7th Court of Appeals District, and 080964, the Edwards Aquifer Authority in the state of Texas versus Burrell Day and Joel McDaniel from Atascosa County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between them. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments should be posted on the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is now ready to hear argument in 080941, Travelers Insurance Company versus Barry Joaquin.
May it please the court, Mr. Slayton will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. This case arises out of an order of dismissal for want of prosecution that was entered with prejudice after the plaintiff took a non-suit. It's our contention that that order of dismissal was initially entered collateral to the merits, and so the court had jurisdiction at the time it entered that order. And only after the order became final with that with prejudice language attached to it did it become a determination on the merits. And at that point, res judicata kicked in and barred the second lawsuit. Brief factual background, Your Honors. On eve of trial, the respondent non-suited the underlying case but failed to obtain an order of dismissal. 2 months later, the trial court issued a notice of intent to dismiss the case for want of prosecution because it had received no final order. The respondent failed to provide that order to the court, and so the court then dismissed the case for want of prosecution, but erroneously did so with prejudice instead of without.
An order that was prepared by Travelers, or was this the court's own order?
This was the court's own order pursuant to its dismissal docket, something generated out of the court and not by either of the parties.
What is the burden shift to the party that's filed a non-suit? Why must they do something more than file the non-suit?
Well, I think the cases stand for the proposition that an order has to be entered. And I don't think you just get to non-suit your case and then walk away. I think the cases are clear about that, that you have a further duty to see that the case gets disposed of. And without that order, then nothing has become final just because you file a non-suit.
But the order is just a ministerial act.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And doesn't that distinguish this case from so many of the authorities that you cite in your brief?
I don't believe it does, because even though it's a ministerial act, it still has to be done. And I think if we look at some of these other cases that talk about dismissing a case for want of prosecution with prejudice, the Labrie case, the Rodriguez case, the El Paso Pipe cases, in those cases, there's not a non-suit involved, but...
That's the key point. In those cases, correct. It wasn't merely a ministerial act.
Correct.
Once a case is moot, then really it's just ministerial, and that's what makes this case unique.
I would say that even if it is ministerial, if it's just a ministerial act, the court still has the power to do that. I think it's what we're looking at in this case. Does the court have the power to enter that order? Now, if it's merely a ministerial act and it doesn't require any jurisdiction, then even an order of dismissal, dismissing the case without prejudice, would be void. And we know that's not the case. An order has to be entered, and what we're looking at here is, does the court have the power to do that? The respondent says in this case that once he filed a non-suit, the merits of the case are withdrawn, that the court can do nothing else but dismiss a case without prejudice.
Well, but the question is, the court has the power to dismiss it. The question is whether that power carries with it an adjudication on the merits that has a res judicata effect.
Correct.
And those are two different questions.
Yes, and I think where the merits res judicata kicks in is once that order becomes final. I don't think at the time the order was entered, the court was clearly just dismissing the case for want of prosecution, not making a merits determination. Merits aren't before the court any more than the merits were before the court in El Paso Pipe, LaBrie, Rodriguez. The merits weren't before the court in those cases either, because the court's dismissing either for want of prosecution or for some procedural defect, such as in Rodriguez, where they failed to obtain leave of court before adding an amended.
But it's still a merits determination. You've got a cause of action. It hasn't been prosecuted. It's a determination on the merits. Once the case has been withdrawn, it takes away the ability to render a merits determination.
Correct. And I agree with you, Your Honor. But I don't believe that at the time the court entered that order. Say if we take a snapshot of the case at that time, the court is not adjudicating the merits, not making a determination on the merits. It's merely performing a ministerial act in dismissing the case.
When the court makes issues an order, signs an order that basically says you can no longer prosecute your cause of action, isn't that a merits determination? You're barred from going forward ever.
Well, I don't believe it is, Your Honor, because I think it could have been remedied. And I think that's where this case can be decided. The respondent had a chance at the time that order was entered with prejudice. With prejudice is a merits determination, although I don't believe initially in this case it was, because if we look at what the court's trying to do at that point.
Well, it's not like the court's just trying to clear its docket. I mean, that's an easy way for the court to clear its docket. You file a motion to dismiss, and the court says, well, okay, we're going to get you. It's dismissed with prejudice, and if you don't do anything, the case is over. There's no equity in that.
Well, I understand that it's not equitable, it's not fair. And this is a technicality, and we benefit from that.
Is there a notice issue, though? I mean, when you talk about whether it's fair or not, did they get a notice of DWOP? Did they have an opportunity after that notice to file a motion to reconsider, et cetera?
They did, Your Honor. There's a contention in the briefing from my opponent that says, we didn't get that notice, we didn't get the order. But I think the presumption under the rules, under Rule 21A, is that they got that.
Getting back to the legal issue, I guess the jurisdictional question, whether or not it's fair, is one question. They had an opportunity to ask the court to withdraw its order. But do you agree then that this is a merits determination after the case had been non-suited?
Don't agree that it's a merits determination initially. I agree that it's a merits determination after it becomes final.
So I think your argument is that it shouldn't be a merits determination, but the trial court, if the order says on the merits or with prejudice, then it turns out to be an erroneous merits determination.
That's correct. There's no question what the trial court did here was wrong in dismissing that case with prejudice. You can't dismiss a case for want of prosecution with prejudice. But what this court said in Mosser versus Shields is that a dismissal with prejudice is a merits determination. And when you let that become final, then at that point, res judicata kicks in, and that order becomes a determination on the merits, though initially it was not.
Why isn't that a void order?
Well, because the court had jurisdiction in what it was trying to do initially. Initially, it says, I see there's been a non-suit filed here. There's no order cleaning off my docket. So I want you to present an order to me. Respondent failed to do that. At that point, the court issues the order itself, dismisses the case, trying to clean off its docket. And so I think if we look at what the court is attempting to do, what it's trying to do there, admittedly wrong in what it ultimately did, but what it's trying to do at that point is clean off its docket. And that's collateral to the merits. That's not a merits determination. Only when it becomes final with prejudice tag attached to it, then at that point we have a whole different situation.
Counsel, sometimes we use the term merits in a broad, general way. Often we mean merits to mean the actual dispute and the facts in the controversy were decided. And sometimes we use merits to mean it's a final judgment to which res judicata attaches. It's the latter that we're here about today.
Correct.
Statute of limitations, for example, aren't necessarily deciding the actual facts in dispute, but it is a merits determination in the sense that it's final and res judicata attaches to it. Let's back up. Why do you say that the trial court was wrong in dismissing with prejudice? Do you think it can never dismiss with prejudice in this circumstance?
I don't believe it can. if it's dismissing for want of prosecution. Cases are clear that a court dismissing a case for want of prosecution with prejudice is clear error. And there's a case that I wanted to point out, Willis versus Barron, out of the Tyler Court of Appeals, it's cited in our brief. I believe it's from 1980. And what the court held there was there was a dismissal for want of prosecution that was entered with prejudice. The plaintiff in that case did what the plaintiff should have done in this case and took that order up on appeal. And when the Tyler Court got it, it said, we understand that Texas law is clear that a dismissal with prejudice, dismissal for want of prosecution with prejudice is clearly error. You can't do that. You have a dismissal collateral to the merits combined with a dismissal on the merits, and you can't do that. And so what the Tyler Court did was said, we understand what the trial court was trying to do. It was trying to clean off its docket. And so we're going to reform that judgment, take out the words with prejudice. And that's an easy fix, and that could have been done in this case, but the point is the plaintiff has to attack that order directly.
He says he never got it, and you say, well, the rules presume he did get it. Well, why can't the presumption be that the trial court did it the right way and didn't commit clear error, as you call it?
I'm not quite sure I follow your question, Justice Willett.
I mean, isn't a litigant who non-suits a case entitled to presume that the case is dismissed without prejudice?
Well, I don't believe so, and that's an issue that I struggle with a little bit in briefing this, but I think there's a clear duty on the plaintiff, even though he non-suits the case. He can't just walk away from the court. As the court said in N. Ray Bennett, that gives an inordinate amount of weight to a non-suit and allows then a plaintiff to essentially have more power than the trial court and dismiss that case and walk away from it and never pay any attention again at what the trial court does. I don't think you can do that. I think there remains some duty to make sure that that case gets dismissed properly. And if it doesn't, then you have that duty then to address that erroneous order that was dismissed with prejudice.
So do you agree? I thought your briefing said around page 17 or so that a non-suit, in fact, withdraws the merits of a case.
That's correct.
And if the merits are withdrawn, then how can a trial court ever make a determination on the merits post non-suit?
Well, I think the answer is it didn't initially. The plaintiff allowed it to become a determination on the merits when it became final. See, I think the problem here is we have a dismissal for want of prosecution that's collateral to the merits, and that's what the trial court was attempting to do. It just so happened that it dismissed it with prejudice instead of without. But the trial court is attempting to dismiss the case clean off its docket. But that error has to be attacked before it becomes final.
What if the plaintiff did not get notice, as they claim they didn't? What would be the avenue of attack? Would it be a bill of review?
That would probably be the avenue to take. And unfortunately, at this point, bill of review is no longer viable. I think you have to bring a bill of review within 4 years of the erroneous order. This order is now almost 10 years old. And so a bill of review, I don't think, is a viable option. And as well, I think with a bill of review, you have to show some kind of fraud or wrongful act on our part as the petitioners in procuring that order, which was argued, I think, in the trial court that we did something, that we submitted this order that said with prejudice, and the record is clear that we did not. So,
well, it really wouldn't matter who submitted the order if your theory is correct, right? Because the order is there, it gets signed by the judge, and
correct.
You know, according to you, the burden shifts to the other side to do something.
I agree with that to the extent that order has become final. I say that to point out the fraud element of the bill of review. If the plaintiff could prove that we did something, submitted an order without showing it to the other side, and it's contained the words with prejudice instead of without, then at that point, maybe there's some issue about fraud and some kind of wrongful act on our part.
Should the rule be different in a case of a DWOP than otherwise? For example, you have a situation where there are two defendants in the case, a plaintiff non-suits one, and there's a summary judgment hearing, and the order erroneously disposes of both defendants. and nothing is done to correct that. Is that the same rule? Should it be the same rule?
I think it's the same rule, and I think the scenario you're talking about, the Amarillo Court of Appeals addressed in Rodriguez versus Icahn, because that's essentially what happened there, is that, and my firm was actually involved in that case, and what happened was the plaintiff, after the case was settled, refiled or filed an amended petition adding a new party, a new defendant. And the court, in dismissing and granting summary judgment to one defendant, also dismissed the other defendant, Icahn. And what the court held there is, I'm sorry, that you have to attack that order, and once it becomes final, even though it's not making a determination on the merits of the case, not trying to bar this plaintiff from having to stay in court, that order becomes final and is res judicata, the second lawsuit is barred. And so I think it is the same rule. I don't believe just because this order contained the words with prejudice that it initially that makes it void. There are plenty of cases out there, as I've talked about, El Paso, LaBrie, and Rodriguez, that essentially hold the same thing, that this dismissal for want of prosecution with prejudice, even though it contains that language, it's not initially a determination on the merits. And that only when that order is allowed to become final does it then become a determination on the merits and res judicata kicks in.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Slayton. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Williams will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, the issues in this case involve the simple concepts of non-suit, of void, and of the timing. In this case, Mr. Joachim, I thought it was Joaquin for about a half a year myself, but his name, he pronounces it the West Texas way of Joachim. He did file a non-suit, and Justice Guzman brings up a good point. Is there a notice issue as to whether the plaintiff received notice from the court that we intend to DWOP your case, and then did we receive an order of dismissal? There's definitely an issue in the case as to whether that was ever received. Joachim, my law firm, contends that it was not. We do understand there's a presumption, however, that it was received. Nonetheless, we will get to the issues of the effect of non-suit and also whether something is void or voidable and how it may be attacked. The purpose in and of itself of the filing of a lawsuit is for a plaintiff to invoke the court's jurisdiction to hear a matter in controversy. That's all we're doing. We want to invoke jurisdiction. Now, once we invoke jurisdiction with our lawsuit, then we can proceed to trial on the merits. And if I could be given just a moment of latitude, when my brother and I were growing up, my dad always had us have kicking and punting contests. He was older. I wanted to wear his shoes that were too big for me. And so when I would try to punt, the ball would slip off to the right side. And my dad would say, no, go get on your shoes that fit you. Go get your house in order, and we'll let you do it over. Because when my dad laid down the law, it was unqualified, and it was absolute. Now, we have something else in Texas that is unqualified and absolute. Pursuant to Rule 162, in this Supreme Court's holding in BHP Petroleum and N. Ray Bennett in 1998, it is a plaintiff's non-suit that is absolute and is unqualified. And what that means is a plaintiff is, in essence, given an opportunity to get its house in order and to be given a do-over, if you will.
What would happen if, when you submitted the order of non-suit, the person responsible for typing the order accidentally put with prejudice in there, the court signed it, and you never challenged it?
Well, if the court signed that, if I presented an order of non-suit and the clerk typed in with prejudice, then that would be just as void as what Judge Medina had his clerk enter.
It wouldn't be final if you didn't challenge that for appellate purposes?
Now, it would become final.
Appellate process.
Yes, Your Honor. It would become final, and that's the problem with this case, is that once that non-suit was entered with prejudice, it was a determination on the merits. And that's a point that I'd like to bring out. In petitioner's petition for review and in the briefing at page 14, the petitioner asserts to this court that the Amarillo court held that even though a dismissal for want of prosecution with prejudice is improper and is not a decision on the merits, But that's not what the labor decision out of Amarillo said at all.
But it can be.
It can be once it becomes final.
No, well, but there's another situation where it can be, and that is plaintiff settles with the defendant, and as a condition of the settlement, plaintiff says, we're going to non-suit, and we'll do it with prejudice.
That's correct. That's correct.
So a dismissal order with prejudice in that situation, by agreement, would be appropriate.
Right, and in that case, it would become final by agreement. And the critical element, Your Honor,
it would be an adjudication on the merits by agreement.
That's right.
It would have preclusive effect.
And that's because the court still has jurisdiction to enter that agreement.
Why? Okay. If you've taken a non, if the agreement in settlement is we've settled the case, I'll take a non-suit with prejudice.
Mm-hmm. And I believe that's the defendant's case or the petitioner's case in the Rodriguez versus Icon Benefit Administrators, that there was a settlement and they had not yet worked out the workers' comp lien. And so the plaintiff in that case said, well, we agreed, and we have this mediation agreement. The court enforced the mediation agreement and dismissed as to both the defendant and then also the intervener, which was Icon Administrators. But the reason that was okay in that situation is because what the court did, they had jurisdiction at that time. And in my case, the court did not have jurisdiction once we filed a motion for non-suit a notice of non-suit.
Talk with me the example of a settlement.
Yes, ma'am.
With an agreed non-suit and dismissal order with prejudice.
Okay.
Would that have a res judicata effect down the road, or would that be a void order?
If the plaintiffs agree to non-suit with prejudice, then that is a done deal.
Well, but under your argument, it would be a void order because after a non-suit, you can't have a dismissal with prejudice. So what you'd have to do is then say that order was void, but if a suit was later filed, there'd be some estoppel argument rather than res judicata.
Well, in this case, the non-suit was taken specifically without prejudice. The notice of non-suit was, we non-suit the case without prejudice. And what the 237th District Court did was they entered an order of non-suit with prejudice. So,
no, I understand, but I'm just saying if we adopt the notion that in every non-suit, if an order follows with prejudice, then it's going to be void, that's going to sweep in the situation where it's an agreed with prejudice.
No, Your Honor, that wouldn't be the case because under that situation, a judge, that's what the parties intend. If the parties intend, if the plaintiff intends to non-suit his case with prejudice because he settled the case, then that is a decision on the merits, and the judge is entering that order, that requested order.
Let's say that you non-suit, and then after you non-suit, you all have this settlement conference, and then you agree that, actually, I wanted to non-suit with prejudice, not just non-suit. Mm-hmm. Can the court enter an order after you've simply made an oral motion to non-suit, to non-suit with prejudice?
Once the non-suit is taken without prejudice, the court is without authority to enter the non-suit with prejudice. I believe it would be incumbent upon the plaintiff to submit a different non-suit saying we are non-suiting without prejudice.
So you're saying once you announce a non-suit in open court, you can't have subsequent negotiations agree to a non-suit with prejudice and the court enter that order?
That is exactly what I'm saying, Your Honor. And the reason I know that I can say that with clarity is that the right exists from the moment the non-suit is filed. And I direct the court's attention to the Corpus Christi decision in 2002 in N. Ray Martinez. That's the school district case where the school district said, hey, we non-suit. We want to back up, get our house in order. And then after it non-suited, it filed its own motion for a new trial. And the court heard it. But the Court of Appeals in Corpus Christi said, no, the court should not have heard the motion for new trial because once you non-suited, the court couldn't hear anything. That at the moment, at the second, at the instant that you declare a non-suit, either in open court or to the district clerk, then it removes all possibility of the court doing anything other than dismissing the case without prejudice.
The Court of Appeals seemed to rely on federal rules in support of its reasoning. Do the federal rules support your approach?
The federal rules, according to the Amarillo Court of Appeals opinion, does support the fact that once you declare non-suit, there's nothing justiciable for the court to hear, that the case merely exists as an empty shell.
But under the federal rules, is it then a void judgment?
It is a void judgment, Your Honor. And that's the point that Mr. Joe Ackman is making in this case, that at the moment the non-suit was taken in accordance with Greenberg and Zimmerman, and actually in accordance with this Supreme Court's holding in 2006 in the Blackmun case, at the moment the non-suit was taken, then there is nothing for the court to decide. There are no matters in controversy.
So in order to clean.
There is some authority, though, I believe, that once a non-suit is taken, for whatever reason, that for the plenary power jurisdiction time of the court, that the other side can come in with move for sanctions or attorney's fees or some other matter. So to that extent, the court still has power to act, and including even, I might add, sanctions to require a non-suit with prejudice.
That is correct, Your Honor. In the Texas Supreme Court's opinion in N. Ray Bennett, that was the case out of Nueces County in the Corpus Christi area. And that's where there was a couple of what maybe I would term slick lawyers that were circumventing the court's random filing process. They had 700 Peruvian clients, and they filed and filed and filed, and the 17th plaintiff actually landed in 105th District Court. And at that point, they got the 105th District Court judge that they wanted, and they joined in 600 other plaintiffs. And the Supreme Court said, no, we're going to allow a sua sponte sanction. Even though a non-suit was taken as to your first 16 plaintiffs, and you got all this in the court that you wanted, we see what you did. And I think critical in this Supreme Court's determination in 1998 in the N. Ray Bennett case at page 40 is that that was a sanction. And this court was very clear in noting on page 40 that the attorneys in that case, number one, were given notice of the court's intention to sanction. And also, they were given an opportunity to respond.
So the
they were given due process.
But that would mean then that the proceedings were not void, that the court had jurisdiction to act.
That's right. It's the only thing the court can do once a non-suit is taken without prejudice, just as in the Joe Ackam case. Here's all that the court can do. You can enter the non-suit without prejudice, or if there are claims for affirmative relief, then there's still some merits to be determined. But the second thing that it can do is enter sanctions, and that's what the Supreme Court's holding in N. Ray Bennett stands for, that there are a few things, while the court still has plenary power, that it can do. It can hear claims for affirmative relief, and it can hear sanctions, even if those sanctions are sua sponte.
Let me ask you a practical question, though. When I was on the trial court, I would have a docket with 5,000 cases a year, and I needed to dispose of 5,000 cases a year. You non-suit, you never bring my court black an order for me to sign. What can the court do to move its docket if you non-suit and take no further action? What does it have jurisdiction to do from a practical standpoint?
From a practical standpoint, what the court could have done, it certainly was able to enter the order dismissing the case with prejudice. What it could have done is enter an order dismissing the case without prejudice. And in fact, that's all it could have done. So if it was within the clerk and the court's power to enter this order with...
So the court makes a mistake and signs an order with prejudice. It meant to sign an order without prejudice. Is there no burden on the litigant to challenge those orders?
Yes, Your Honor, I do understand your question. The burden would be I can either attack it directly or collaterally. And so Mr. Joe Ackam was given an opportunity, could have filed a motion for new trial, could have perfected and effective my appeal, filed a bill of review, and have Mr. Joe Ackam incur those costs. However, if what the court did was void, which all the case law in the state of Texas dating back to the Norton decision in 1927, once the non-suit is taken, anything that happens after that, if it's not a sanction, and if there are no claims for affirmative relief, it's void. And so I did have an opportunity to attack it directly by way of appeal, motion for a new trial, bill of review, or had an opportunity to attack it collaterally by refiling my case in another court of competent and equal jurisdiction, which we did.
If we agree with you, you could go into courthouses across the state and find a lot, I bet, of orders in which the trial court dismissed with prejudice after a non-suit. So all those cases are alive. They're just dormant. I mean, they can be re-urged at this point 10, 20 years later.
What the case law says in Texas is that those cases exist merely as an empty shell. Nothing can be done with those cases except that ministerial act of going ahead and entering that order. The ministerial act is referenced in the Greenberg decision and also in Newman Oil. That the order of non-suit, all that is, it's just a paper rendition of what has to take place. That's why it's a ministerial act. So in answer to your question, yes, all of those cases exist as an empty shell. There's nothing to decide. There are no matters in controversy, just as in the Joe Ackam case. There were no matters in controversy at the moment.
But as Justice Green pointed out, then there would be plenary power to issue sanctions potentially, right, in those cases?
There could be plenary power to issue sanctions, but the plenary power, timetable, I believe, would start, well, that's a good point, because the plenary power timetable starts once there's an active and proper dismissal. So that's correct. But
the statute of limitations would continue to run, so there wouldn't be reviving of dormant judgments over a certain period of time.
That's exactly right, and that is why Mr. Joachim was able, he was within his four-year statute of limitations on this breach of contract and underinsured motorist claim, filed, I believe, back in 02 when 2155 and 2121 had the teeth that it had back then, and he was well within the statute. But the non-suit was taken so he could get his house in order. What we learned from the case is that at the time his underinsured motorist claim was pending against his own carrier, he had to have a three-level fusion. And so to get his house in order, we take the non-suit, which is our absolute and our unqualified right to do. Now, once we do that, gets his house in order, has his surgery, of course, there's a whole lot more medical expenses, we refile our case in an equal court or a court of competent jurisdiction. And so we had that right to do that. We attacked the 237th decision in a collateral manner as opposed to a direct manner. We get to the issue of void versus voidable. It's important to note that the four cases brought forth in the defendant's petition for review and brief on the merits indicate that those cases have nothing to do with non-suits. Not a single one of those cases dealt with a non-suit. What those cases dealt with and stood for the proposition is a court makes a mistake when it DWOPs a case with prejudice, or if it just dismisses the case with prejudice, assuming you don't have a DWOP situation. But in the case at bar, clearly all the court could do was enter the non-suit without prejudice. And in doing anything other than that, since there were no claims for affirmative relief pending, what it did was void. It had no effect whatsoever, and the case law in Texas says that I have that absolute right to take the non-suit, and then if I want to attack that, I can do it in either manner, do it directly or do it collaterally. And since we understood that sanctions were a possibility, if by some stretch of the imagination, an appellate court or a second trial court or a new judge hearing the case thought that what Judge Medina intended to do back when he dismissed it with prejudice was in essence ordering a sanction against Mr. Joachim or against my law firm and not providing that order of dismissal without prejudice for them, that simple piece of paper that's the ministerial act. If by some chance that a new court or a further court thought that that would be a sanction, what the plaintiff would have to be afforded is due process, be given notice that it was a sanction, and be given an opportunity to respond. And that's exactly why the N. Ray Bennett decision of this court back in 1998 set that forth at page 40, that the attorneys, if it is a sanction, you're going to be afforded due process. In our case, what we know is that it wasn't a sanction. It was merely an act that was void. It had no effect whatsoever. In my brief, and also in my response to the petition, I had presented a scenario for the court to consider that we feel is applicable. If we have a heavyweight fight, back in the day it was 15 rounds, now it's 12 rounds, you fight to an even draw pretty much, and after the bell sounds, someone is walking back to their corner. And as he's walking back to the corner after the bell sounds, he's clocked and he's knocked out. There is no referee in the world that will say the person is knocked out. After the bell sounds, it's moot and void what happens after the bell. That is exactly the situation that we have in the Joachim case. There is nothing that Judge Medina could have done in this case after we declare our notice of non-suit other than dismiss it without prejudice. When he dismissed it with prejudice, it was void, and that was a mistake. Now, certainly, courts have jurisdiction. And while they have jurisdiction, trial courts commit mistakes all the time. They do things that are improper all the time, and they have the power to do that. If they didn't make mistakes all the time, I believe the nine of you would be out of a job. But there are mistakes made. What is critical to the Joachim case, and I can't stress it strongly enough, is that the mistake that was made was void because the 237th District Court was without power, was without jurisdiction to do anything other than dismiss the case without prejudice.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Would the trial court's judgment have been a void judgment under the federal rules?
I don't don't believe that, well, under the federal rules, yes. The answer is yes. But I don't believe the federal rules are anything like what the Texas rules are. Rule 41 of the federal rules specifically provides that no order is needed, that once the plaintiff files a voluntary dismissal, that ends the case. That's clear. That's not what we have in Texas. You still are required to have that order dismissing the case to remove it from the court's docket. Under the federal rules, once the plaintiff files that voluntary dismissal, the case is over. And the reason for that is because Rule 41 provides that dismissal is entered at a time when the defendant has not appeared yet, has not filed an answer. And so there's nobody there to hurt. And so I don't feel like the federal rules are applicable at all. And these cases cited by Amarillo regarding that from Oklahoma, from Illinois, I don't think we need to go there when Texas law provides a clear answer, in my opinion. So no, I don't believe the federal rules would apply for that reason. I think going back to what Justice Jefferson mentioned, is that if we lay down a rule that says that all of these orders dismissing cases with prejudice after a non-suit are void, then I think we opened up Pandora's box there. We have a lot of orders sitting out there that could potentially be revived again. Those cases are not sitting out there still alive. Those are over. And any second lawsuit that is filed on those cases is barred by res judicata, and you can't come back in now and revive those cases by saying, well, that order dismissing that case after a non-suit with prejudice was void.
If part of a settlement agreement is a dismissal with prejudice and no motion to dismiss is filed, but simply an order is submitted to the judge, an agreed order dismissing with prejudice, now, what would be your position on that?
Well, I think that happens all the time.
And what is it? Is it void or voidable, or is it final?
I think it's final. Okay. I think it's an agreement made by the parties.
There's no motion to dismiss in that case. It's simply a dismissal order with prejudice.
Correct.
All right. Now then, what if if in fact a motion to dismiss is filed, settlement agreement, motion to dismiss is filed, and then a dismissal with prejudice. And in that case, that would be the situation Justice O'Neill was talking about. In that case, if the case is refiled, then you have a settlement agreement behind the dismissal, correct?
That's correct. You have...
Whether it's a dismissal with prejudice or without prejudice, you still have the case settled and you have limitations and you have all those things.
Right. That's correct. And I think in that situation, if what the trial court did was dismiss it other than what the parties had desired, then you have a duty to go and attack that order within the 30 days that the court retains jurisdiction over that case.
But the defendant's still going to be protected if you have a settlement agreement signed by everyone, even with a minor.
That's correct.
You have the trial court approving the settlement on behalf of the minor. So even if the dismissal is erroneously entered, as opposing counsel says, it's erroneously entered with prejudice after a motion, and then the suit is refiled even on behalf of the minor 5 or 6 years later, you come in and you plead your settlement agreement and file
That's
a
correct.
Motion to summary judgment.
That's correct. You've got a release with the plaintiff signing that saying, I dismiss all of my claims, release any and all claims that I may have. They are done and over with, and you've got that to back up the order of dismissal.
But that's based on an estoppel theory and not res judicata.
Correct. Your Honors, in closing, I'm running out of time here, but a couple of weekends ago, I was watching the Super Bowl, and I had this case running around in my head, which is kind of sick, I guess. Supposed to be relaxing, having fun, but I'm focusing on this case, and it comes to me that this case is a lot like the NFL system of instant replay. In instant replay in NFL, the coach has a red challenge flag, and he has an obligation to throw that red flag if he wants to review the previous play. But he has to review that within the time frame allotted.
So you're Coach Payton?
Yes, correct.
But
correct.
You have to do it within the game clock. And, if you do it after the game clock,
If you do
it, something happens after the touchdown's made after the clock's run, it doesn't matter, which is opposing counsel's argument. So that analogy kind of works both ways.
Well, if you don't challenge that before the snap in the next play, which is the time frame allotted, the play is final, it's over with, and you can't come back after the game is over and challenge that play. And that's what the respondent is doing here, is coming back after the game is over.
So you and opposing counsel at least both agree on one thing. This case is like a football game.
That's correct. There's a sports analogy in here somewhere. So. Thank you.
Thank you. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.